ऐसी मशीन लगाऊंगा इस साइड से आलू बनेगा उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Hi and welcome to episode 107 of Attention Plus with Arnab Ray. We are recording on the 22nd of November 2020. I am Vikram Mohan, also reminding you to check out the other podcasts from Forspire. The latest Binge On, which is out now, has four English drama series which you can watch, and WhatsApp Geeks, which should be out on Monday. We discuss Apple Silicon. So check them both out at forspire.net. That's the number 4spire.net. And now, on with the podcast and your host, Arnab. Hey, Arnab.
Hello. Hello. The reason why I stumbled was that I just now got a message which, are you by chance interested in a free personalized Bible study with the local missionaries of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? And we would love to meet you and study with you.
That's the Mormons?
This just popped up. This just popped up just when you were introducing me. So I just had to take a step back.
LDS is the Mormon church, right?
No, I don't think so. I think so. Latter-day Saints is something different. Yeah, it is the Mormon church. You're right. I didn't know that they were the Mormon church. Okay. So it's Mormons. Okay.
Oh, that should be interesting.
I have no idea why.
So what, this was a text message or an email or somebody you know?
No, it came on my Facebook. So it's so this is basically
the AI at its finest.
I'm just clicking through the thing. So the person who sent it is, so on my Facebook, I actually in order to kind of, I don't know why I do it, but in sort of to hide my location, I say I'm living in College Park, which I used to like two cities ago.
That's Maryland.
And so this person stays in, yes. So this person is basically, I think, spamming everybody who stays in College Park, because this person says lives in College Park, Maryland. So that's the reason, I think.
My brother once he visited Salt Lake City for some business. And maybe he must, I don't know, they must have dropped their card, or one of his colleagues dropped their card in some Benihana's or God knows where. And he started getting mails and even, asking if somebody can come and visit them too, which is kind of...
Yeah, the thing about Mormons is that they're very polite and they're very...
Extremely, yeah, to a fault.
Yeah, so let's just say that they're not trying to convert you by, putting a sword to your neck. They're very polite and but ultimately, I think every attempt at conversion comes from, I just feel it comes from a position of aggression somehow. I mean, no matter how you present yourself, no matter how you present, whether you want to be like you're going to hell or you're like, let's have a conversation about God, whatever it is, I think it ultimately comes from an expansionist, aggressive stance, no matter how you... and I wasn't going to talk about that, but it's just that this happened right when I was starting the podcast. And this is, I have received messages from many Desis who want to start a business opportunity with me, which I presume is a pyramid scheme. But this, again, is the first time that I have been, that Christian missionaries are reaching out to me over Facebook. Anyways.
The Mormon church kind of adopts Akshay Kumar's philosophy from Dhadkan, I guess. Win them over with love, kind of a thing.
I guess so. All I will say is, and my response to them will be, nahin. Like, it's I'm not interested in converting. All right. So, today what we're going to discuss wanted to start.
Sorry. Since you did talk about converting, maybe you would want to, that might be a good segue into one of the things you wanted to talk about.
No, the first thing that I want to talk about was, and I kind of missed talking about this person who I increasingly find getting more and more despicable by the day, is Virat Kohli. I don't know what is going on with this guy, but at one point of time, he was just this, abusive guy. And but of late, I think he's kind of moving into the domain of, I don't think I've hated a guy in Indian cricket so much as I do now. Virat Kohli, everything about him is just, I mean, and I'm specifically referring to his behavior with Surya Kumar Yadav in that Mumbai Indians game. I mean, this difference in terms of class between him and Surya Kumar Yadav came out. Like, look, he is this guy who is a billionaire many times over. He is definitely one of the best batsmen in the world. There is nothing can take away that from him. And then there is this other guy who possibly is never going to get there. Because I think he's kind of in the middle of his career, Surya Kumar Yadav, and I don't think that he's going to have a long and successful career. But just look at the context. This guy just that day wasn't selected to make it to the Australia team. And what does the person who is at least partially responsible for that do in a game with him? I mean, can you imagine any other kind of, because ultimately cricket, with the amount of money that's involved, is ultimately a corporate thing. This is not just a few friends hanging out and challenging each other in the afternoon. This is as corporate can be. And if there's one thing that Virat Kohli understands, is corporate culture. You just can't do that and I think the bigger, and I will use the word criminal, knowing fully well the import of this, is BCCI for letting him get away with this. And this has happened because of the increasing latitude that has been given to him with respect to, you know, that toady which he appointed as a coach, that disgrace called Ravi Shastri, who the only other place that Ravi Shastri can get employment is the Congress Working Committee in terms of obsequiousness. His capability, caliber, and his biggest USP is all aligned with what it takes to be a Congress leader. And it's pathetic to see that our cricket captain is no better. And just the way he came, I had kind of forgotten to mention this, but I was watching, somehow it came up in my YouTube thing again, and just saw it made my blood boil. And just to see Surya Kumar Yadav kind of walk away, because ultimately, what else could he do?
Describe the incident for folks who have not seen the video.
Okay, so for those of you who have not seen the video, what happened was that Surya Kumar Yadav was batting against Bangalore, which right now, I mean, there's another point, and Virat Kohli's performance as a batsman for Bangalore is nothing for him to be proud about. I mean, forget his abject captaincy and the fact that he has been captaining this franchise, which has pumped in a lot of money into him as well as procuring fairly good cricketers. I don't think they have had bad teams in the way Kolkata Knight Riders has. They have had pretty decent teams, and they have always punched way below their weight. So in terms of performance, both as a captain as well as a batsman, Virat Kohli should be in the last to be super aggressive. He should actually keep his eyes on his feet and keep his head down at this point of time. So they were playing against Mumbai, which happens to be the team which can actually genuinely pride itself on its performance, and which now is strong enough, I believe, and I read this somewhere, I actually believe it can field two good teams and it could be number one and number two in IPL. It is that amount of depth. And here there is Surya Kumar Yadav who's batting and who's bashing Bangalore, the Bangalore team. And he's really done nothing. He's batting beautifully. He's not been selected for the Indian cricket team to go to Australia. Now, I'm not saying that's per se a terrible move. I honestly don't think he has the technique to, I mean, the kind of batsman he is. He's limited, I believe. In the kind of pitches that he can play on. He doesn't, at least in my opinion, he doesn't cut it at that level. But, you know, you could give him a chance and you could see. I mean, I would have, Mayank Agarwal also, when he initially started, I felt so. But then he had a very good series in Australia last time as a test opener. So, you know, you never can say. But whatever it is, I'm not casting aspersions on the decision not to select him. That's, you know, that happens. We have a very good team in terms of, and, you know, it might be that, you know, later on when somebody gets injured, he gets to play, whatever it is. But the fact is that they're playing on that day and Kohli just goes after him. Nothing. As he normally does against anybody who's on the opposite side who's playing well. And
Of course, because it's Kohli, the umpires don't say anything. Nobody says anything. He'll do whatever he wants at this point of time. He's kind of become the archetype of I can shoot anyone on Fifth Avenue and nobody will say anything. It's really true for Virat Kohli at this point of time. And what you see over there, you see, what is heartbreaking is, he goes up to this guy who's powerless in every respect. But unfortunately, he might be powerless in terms of the organizational structure that they have, but in terms of cricket, he's playing way better than Virat Kohli. So, and I think Virat Kohli realizes that. I think that, that the hallmark of being Virat Kohli is that ultimately his aggression comes from the fact that this guy is playing better than him and he's taking his team to a victory and he can't. That's really where the frustration comes from. Because one of the things about a bully is that a bully is intensely aware of his shortcomings. So Virat Kohli goes, and this is where it's so tragic that we have given the captaincy of the Indian national team to somebody who you just cannot love. You just cannot. And I'm really sad for people who are coming into cricket right now. I mean, we grew up with, whatever you thought of Sachin as a captain or Azhar as a captain, and what came out later, what was revealed about, the fact is none of them were people who you would feel ashamed of on a cricket field. I've come to see that I am at age where I actually feel ashamed of supporting a team which has Virat Kohli as the captain. What Surya Kumar Yadav did was, he heard whatever and he didn't react. He just walked. I'm pretty sure that he could have said a lot of things. But he knows that, look, guy, this guy, I will if I want to get into the team, I can't piss this guy off. And this disparity of power coming out in such a naked and blatant way in a very public stage. And this is corporate life. You cannot get away with this in any other corporation. You cannot get away with this. But Virat Kohli can, and he's been allowed. So I don't think that ultimately the villain here is Virat Kohli. I think Virat Kohli is just a spoiled brat. And the villain really over here is BCCI. Because based on the amount of money that he brings in through his sponsorships, that they are unwilling to rub him the wrong way. And by the way, Virat Kohli has a very good IT cell game going on now in Twitter. This is the first time I've seen an Indian cricket captain investing, I would say, in a fan base of this. So the moment this happened, people started saying that Virat Kohli is, all these other, chutias are basically going after Virat Kohli. Can you be, he gives 50% of his salary apparently to an old age shelter, which is absolutely not true. There was one game in which he get 50% once upon a time. And I had tweeted and I'd shown the link that he does not give it as a pattern or as a habit. So again, where does this from? Where does this fake news come from? This doesn't come from, and this is, again, it's not one account, it's a number of accounts. So this comes from the exact same IT cell script. You have a script, you have a fake story, which might have some smidgen of truth, but it's not the truth at all. And then this is exactly how Virat Kohli is extending his influence in this side. And I think day started when he was allowed to get away by kicking out Anil Kumble and Zahir Khan. I think that was the day when BCCI basically lost control of him. And now basically he can do anything he wants. Anyhow, this is what this is the way what I started off with. So the second thing that I wanted to talk today was about the love jihad bills that are apparently coming out in 5 BJP states. Though I don't know what the details of the bills are. Have they come up? If they have said what the details are?
No draft yet. The one comment was that it was it'll be against forced conversion, but nothing drafted yet, to my knowledge.
So for what I have seen, and again, let's just look at. So for me, let's start off with the TLDR over here. I, of course, don't support any kind of. I don't even like. I mean, not like. That's just a mild form. The term love jihad, because first of all, this has been publicly stated by the government of India. There's absolutely no evidence that there is an organized plan to convert women by marrying them. There is absolutely, so if at all, because this is what the term implies. It is not a term by its very nature by the fact that politicians are using it. It is such a, I would say, such a hateful and false term that there is an organized campaign, in the sense that, on the other hand, there is a political jihad. That is true. There are organizations supported by Pakistan who are doing that. There is no doubt about that either. And liberals would want to say that that doesn't exist, but that does exist. And there have been multiple manifestations of it. So that is also true. But the opposite is also true, that there is really no, quote-unquote, the underpinnings of what love jihad is that has ever existed in our country. That doesn't mean, and that doesn't, and the opposite of it, and I know that the counter to this will, what about this case? And of course, there will be isolated cases where somebody has hidden their religion, married someone, and tried to convert them. I am absolutely sure that happens. I also will castigate media which hides these in certain cases by hiding the names, because they believe that if they acknowledge one case of this, that they're actually endorsing the hate. That is not true. Because by actually hiding the fact, what they do is they make this, the job of the other side much easier, because they will go and say, look, here's Indian Express or Hindustan Times or whatever. Here's an article where you see that the names of the people have been hidden. Here are the names of the people. Now, do you understand how many stories they hide? Now, that third part isn't true. But because the first two are true, you immediately presume that the third part is true. That's the way the human mind works. And by doing this, liberals actually do a disservice. This is exactly the same disservice they do when they try to change history. Because nowadays, you just can't change history by basically denying it happened. There was a time in the 50s and the 60s when you had Sarkari historians who could write history books, and there was no Twitter, there was nothing, that there was no, and the world's knowledge did not lie at your fingertips. Nobody could actually go in Google's other primary sources and show that these people were essentially lying. So in those days, you could actually do it. You actually could hide things. But in this day and age, you can't. So that's there, but that still doesn't show. And the government has never said that there is an organized conspiracy to convert people. As hilarious as it sounds, in the sense that there would be an organized conspiracy that works on the weapon of seduction. Because it's not love, actually. Besides, of course, the incongruity of that. Just take a step back and try to look at it from the problem.
I'm imagining
of
a bunch what of exactly Austin powers.
So, yes, exactly. So I just so none of this, you know, other than the fact that this is a very popular WhatsApp trope. Other than that, there is really no foundation. This is very similar to election malpractice in the U.S. has kept on saying it just doesn't exist, and it might have existed. There might be one or two votes cast here and there which might have been fraudulent, but that doesn't mean there is a systemic problem. Now, with respect to this, with respect to quote unquote love jihad, the essential problem is this, that people will say, look, nobody is against interfaith marriages. They're talking about forcible conversions, and they're talking about misrepresenting people's religion. Well, first of all, the existing law exists to handle that. The people who are quote unquote being love jihaded, if I might use the term with full acknowledgement of its irony, it's not as if they are being quote unquote love jihaded because there is no law that they can take recourse to. It's that they're choosing not to take recourse to that law. They're two distinct things. So there is enough legal teeth for anybody to say that they were coerced into marriage or that they are being coerced after marriage. As a matter of fact, there is a whole group of men's rights activists who say that Indian laws are absolutely biased towards women when it comes to making these sort of claims. So even keeping that to the side, the fact is that the legal recourse remains. If somebody believes that their husband is trying to force them to do anything, whether it's not just changing their religion, but let's say quit their job, whatever it is. If anybody feels that their individual rights are being violated in a violent way, then they absolutely have within the legal structure as is available today to take help of the courts and law administration. As a matter of fact, again, I'll come to it. The laws are very, very women friendly at this point of time. And if it is not, if people feel that is the problem, then the solution is different. It is not to have a separate law which basically regurgitates everything that is already there. Now, the problem, once the real problem that as we as adults should understand is the fallacy that, you know, they are taking our women by basically lying and by hiding. The fact is, they are not your women. Okay. Every individual is theirs. So ultimately, what comes down to, the way I see it, is, and I don't use this word lightly, I find sometimes that this word is overused in today's world for pretty much anything, but the place where it has to be used, because this is the right place to use it, and the word is patriarchy. This is it. The fact that an adult woman, we're talking about, again, if this is an underage, there are legal protections against underage marriage. But if legally somebody wants to get married, and then somebody, after they get married, they decide to get converted, and people feel this, she's not really, she doesn't really want to convert, she's being forced to convert. The fact is, just by having this law, if you feel that just by having this law, this is not going to help that person in any shape or form. The thing is, people to take a step back and see, look, a person decides to make a choice. And if that person decides to make a choice, it's none of your business. It's none of the state's business, none of your business as a member of her community as to the choice that she has taken. So if you feel that she is choosing abuse because she has been mentally brainwashed or whatever, she's an adult. She has every right to be mentally brainwashed. She will live with the consequences of her actions. It is not your problem. And this, again, is where you have an overreach of the state. The state is only too happy to step into personal lives of people. As we progress, one of the pursuits of progress should be to make the state be scoped on things that the state should handle. The state should not be legislating on, and today I saw this, not just who are being love jihadist. Look, there's a man who's being love jihadist too. So women and men should be allowed to make their own choice with respect to their religion. Again, and this is true right now, any interfaith religious marriage has to go through a much higher hoops of registration than an intrafaith marriage. So as it is, there is legal oversight on this. It's existed since I don't know how long. And again, if somebody feels that there is coercion, the woman's family can definitely approach the law. But ultimately, it is the woman's or the man's, whoever is in the relationship, their decision. And if they choose to take a religion, to take a decision to convert, maybe they are being pressurized. This is not the only pressure in any kind of marriage. Let's just be pragmatic. Most marriages, you have to, you know, where you, even in a marriage between Hindus, where there is no conversion, there is a lot of things that change, or people feel they're forced to change in order to stay in the marriage. And it's an individual choice that everybody makes as to whether that change that is being expected of me is worth the cost of staying in the marriage. And, you know, some people know it's not, and they walk out. They may walk out immediately. They may walk out after a few years. They might give it a chance and then they decide to walk out. Whatever it is, this is not within the purview of the state. As long as it's an adult who's getting married, as long as there's not a gun which is being placed to their head while they're getting married. And again, there are laws which prevent that from happening. These laws, these laws haven't been formulated again, but these laws don't bring anything more than what is already there, except it checks off a box in election manifestos. That's exactly what it does. And it also is kind of a lightning rod for people to say that, look, India is becoming anti-minorities because of the way the whole thing is being phrased. I mean, ultimately, if the thing is that somebody genuinely feels that there is data that people are being converted, and there is none. So there is no data which is driving this, first of all. Second, the legal structure to prevent this from happening exists. Third, the isolated cases that this thing is happening, it doesn't mean that these things aren't happening. That's also not true. It is the people in that compact who are taking the decision. And they might not be 100% satisfied with that. But guess what? That's marriage. I mean, anybody who's married will know that even if you married somebody from the same religion, you know, you do make compromises. And, you know, things don't work out. And sometimes you make major compromises. And again, it's your decision. And the government cannot step in on one aspect of the compromise that is on the one aspect of the compromise that is religion and then not step in. I mean, once you accept that, they can step in on anything else. And, you know, most governments are only too happy to come in and step in on the essential sovereignty of individuals. They're only too happy. And so once you allow this, you know, you're opening the doors. And for somebody who firmly believes in limited government, and as it is in India, we have a little bit more government than we should. I totally oppose this for various reasons. I mean, that's my comment on this.
And one of the points made by, in fact, a lot of women, very right point about this is that it shows the priorities, right? I mean, what is desperately needed is a law on marital rape, but that's nowhere on the table. And they're picking up this this issue, which, like you said, doesn't really need a new law.
Again, exactly. So the fact is, the fact is that this is again one of those socially divisive issues that are very good vote catchers, I would say. This law doesn't accomplish anything new. This is basically the BJP analog of the Communal Violence Act that the Congress tried to bring in during the closing years of the UPA, which was exactly this. From the other side, which was to victimize, right, which was to essentially make a law which targeted target communal violence as long as it was being done by Hindus, but essentially delegitimizing any violence which was done on Hindus by explicitly hard coding the definition of what minority was, even though there are places in the country where Hindus are in a minority. And so this is exactly, and they weren't successful in passing that, by the way, but that was again communally supercharged law which had no place in whatever. I know the word secular itself has kind of become a swear word nowadays, but I still like to think that it means something. And this law does not help anyone. And my main concern is that ultimately it's another law which essentially legitimizes, and again I use the word, it legitimizes the patriarchal control over the right of women, primarily right of women, to make a choice. So the next thing that I wanted to talk about was the new COVID vaccine. And I had a conversation on Twitter. And the reason why I wanted to say, and I wish we could have an audio of at this point of Dr. Nafees Mangi here from Club. but there is this comforting, I would say, hatred of medical professionals and of big pharma. So in India, especially in Bengal, you often hear of, you know, doctors being beaten up by patients. This has happened, as you know, this was a well publicized thing that happened a year ago.
Across India. All of this began. Across India, yes.
Across India. And so the main thing is that most people have very, first of all, let's accept it that the relationship between you and your doctor is never going to be good, because when you go to the doctor, you obviously have a problem mostly. And the doctor is, and when I say doctor, I mean the entire healthcare industry is, it's a business. There are people who are paying their bills based on it. So ultimately, you are dealing with, at that point of time, a group of people who are out to make a profit. Now, there are some people who say that healthcare cannot have a profit motive. Obviously, if you say that, then there will be no healthcare at all, because nothing in the world has ever run without a profit motive. So saying that somehow healthcare is supposed to be profitless or supposed to be provided at cost basically makes sure that there will be, that first of all, healthcare will go to the gutter, and then after some time, there will be no healthcare. So this is, again, something which is untenable. This, it comes from a very Manoj Kumar kind of understanding of the way the world works. And I'm not, and when I use Manoj Kumar, I should hyphenate it with Manoj Kumar Bernie Sanders view of the way world works, where Bernie Sanders openly, and this comes from a person who's, which is why I don't think of him any differently than I would think of Donald Trump. You know, that these people are murderers, you know, pharma companies are murderers. There's no difference between him and Donald Trump. One person thinks Mexicans are rapists. One person thinks that, you know, pharma companies are murderers. So they basically vilify entire classes. This is, they slap pejorative labels on entire classes based on absolutely no data and without recognizing the individuality of situations as well as nuance and complexity. So let's try to pare this conversation down to these vaccines. So again, once there is, of course, an avalanche of negative sentiment on big pharma companies. So one of the things, as I saw with Bernie Sanders saying, and of course, there are many, because, you know, it's everybody hates on the pharma companies and healthcare industry precisely because everybody has a bad healthcare story. Everybody has it. And there's nobody who you can say that, have you ever had a good experience with the healthcare industry? That usually is never the case. And even if they have had 10 good experiences, it'll always be that one bad experience. And I have had multiple bad experiences. Also realize the fact that is inevitable. I've had bad experiences with computer vendors. I have experiences with pretty much every service that I can think of. This is the very nature of dealing with any kind of service which operates on profit. You are going to have bad experiences because their job is to basically squeeze out as much money as they can from you. And it doesn't matter who it is. So if you believe that healthcare is supposed to be different, then the problem is with you. That healthcare is not supposed to be different. As a matter of fact, the fact is, and this is what the point I wanted to make. If what is coming out, if the clinical data is true, that, you know, you have two vaccines now which have a greater than 90% success rate that have been developed within this short an amount of time, this is essentially going to save the world at this point of time. There's no other. We have come to, I hope that there's nobody now at least after nearly almost a year now. It's not a year, but it's definitely 9 months of what we have been living through. And we are now, the next 3 months are going to be the worst in terms of the number of people who are going to die. You know, some estimates is whatever people have died before in the nine months, in the next 3 months, the same amount of people are going to die. So thinking of that, the dire winter that we are going to face collectively as the human civilization, the only thing that stands between us and essentially hopelessness is the news of these pharma companies, what they claim to have come up with. I'm not doubting that what they're saying is not true, but it's still, I mean, I'll believe it once I get the shot in my arm and kick the butt of coronavirus. So I will not believe it until then. But the fact is that, and immediately when it came out, Bernie Sanders said these companies should provide this vaccines free of cost because the American government taxpayers paid $1 billion So first of all, Bernie and his numbnuts need to understand the way the pharma company works. And a lot of people need to understand the way drug prices work. First of all, when you pay high drug prices, it's not as if the drug company gets all of it, first of all. There's a lot of middlemen that come in between you and the drug company. As a matter of fact, one of the one of the presidential executive orders that Trump passed 2 days ago was essentially trying to, you know, bring out the pharmacy middleman out in, and this was not in general, but in Medicaid, which is really the government-run healthcare. So to kind of make redundant the middleman in drug, in basically buying drugs in bulk, which is expected to bring down the cost. And some people are saying it won't bring down the cost if you bring the middleman down. It'll just be that that other people will start making the money, which the skeptic in me kind of believes, yeah, I guess so. But the point that I'm trying to make is that it's not as if that the exorbitant drug prices you see, they're all going to drug companies. Second is that, and this is again something which people don't understand, or they don't want to understand, is that the drug business is an extremely risky business in terms of most drugs that are developed just don't work out. They go through extremely costly clinical trials. There's a huge amount of governmental regulation, and valid too. This is something which the government should definitely regulate. Not love jihad. This is what the government should be regulating. That there's an enormous amount of regulation and oversight that drug companies have to go through. And guess who pays for it? It's the customer who has to pay for it. So in order for you to have research, so how did you have a drug which was developed in such a short time? Well, you basically have really, really good people on your payroll, and you have an apparatus that allows you to do research at that scale. Now, this is, again, something that doesn't come for free. So this is, again, what Bernie and his bros don't understand, is that that $1 billion was basically to finance the research. That doesn't mean that it finances the operational expenses of producing and distributing the goddamn drug. That's a totally different thing. So the research that goes into making an Android iPhone isn't the same as the cost of production of an iPhone. And what the government gives to drug companies through NIH grants is it basically provides a level of funding. It provides a subsidy. Now, you can say these guys are subsidized, but guess what? Government provides subsidies for crops too. Bernie Sanders won't, if he won't be a politician, if he can go to Iowa and say, hey, the government, subsidizes these cornfields, give the corn to us for free. He wouldn't dare say it. But he will because it helps him to rile up his base and, you know, for him to get money from them. That's exactly why he does so. So he can't do it in Iowa. If he goes and says that in Iowa, the Democrats will, you know, any Democratic candidate will say this in Iowa. Remember that, you know, in any Democratic primary, the first primary is held in Iowa. So nobody can say this, even though the farmers in Iowa and that surrounding region are immense beneficiaries of subsidies from the U.S. federal government. But everybody is perfectly fine with that, because it's politically incorrect to attack a farmer, even though these farmers have huge farms and are as rich as, and this is true in India too. As in a previous episode, I talked about when we had the farm bills, that, you know, this whole smokescreen that people are saying these are the small farmers. No, these are not small farmers who are protesting. These are really, really rich farmers. And some of the people showed up in the protest driving expensive foreign cars. So these people who in India, whose interests were being compromised, were super, super, super rich farmers with huge feudal landlords. They're huge feudal landlords, essentially. So coming back to the drug company, the fact that we were able to have a drug like this produced for an innovative new virus, essentially a variation of a cold virus, really, because that's the cold corona thing, is the reason why pharma companies have to keep a standing army. And the standing army, in order to keep a standing army, that costs money. And when the government subsidizes drugs, this is an investment into public health. Now, does that mean that the pharma companies are not making money? Yes, they're making money. But somehow, that's the thing. For me, Amazon making money by selling PlayStations, I mean, if we look at the morality of it, that's while, you know, Amazon workers are, you know, made to work like galley slaves. That to me is a much more egregious violation. But, you know, people are perfectly, they don't want to talk about Amazon because everybody has an Amazon Prime membership. That's the reason. And the fact is your interaction with Amazon is never bad. I mean, lot more people will have terrible interactions with the healthcare system than they will have with Amazon. So it never really gets the rap that it should. It's usually healthcare. And this is dangerous. It's not just a question of idle. This is why doctors get beaten up. You know, it's not that there aren't bad doctors. There are bad doctors. There are bad doctors. There are bad pharma companies. But there are bad people everywhere. It's just that doctors see us at a state when we are at our most vulnerable. And I get the fact that there are certain restrictions in the way that when you are falling sick, your purchasing ability at that point of time, should I go to this hospital? Should I go to that hospital? You do not have the same kind of option that you have when you're buying a PlayStation 5. Should I buy this at Best Buy or should I buy it at Amazon? Because you have that choice, that's why the price of a PlayStation 5 is exactly the same as it is in Best Buy as it is in Amazon. Because everybody knows that, you know, I can't sell it for a cent less because the guy's going to Google and find it out anyways. So let's sell it at exactly the same price. With hospitals, at least in the US, and I guess in the India too, that is not true because there is a lack of price transparency. So yes, have that price transparency. Why isn't there an app which allows anybody to compare the cost of, let's say, going to an emergency room immediately? If I say, okay, look, I am in this location, I have my foot, what is the cost? What is the cheapest hospital around here? There is no app. I'm pretty sure the reason why there is, and I'm pretty sure people have thought about this, is that the billing of these hospitals, they don't let that information be publicly known. They have different kinds of billing. They have different kinds of costs that they give to this insurance versus that insurance. And those are all secret things. And they charge the public. See, that is where the attention should be. The attention should be for price openness. The fact that, you know, why would you charge a normal user more, a person who's uninsured more than you would charge insurance? That is what the government. So yes, there is requirement for price control, but the price control doesn't happen at the, my goodness, why is this flu shot, you know, $50 or $100 or $150? That is not the thing. As long as I tell you openly, this is what the price is. And, you know, it's not that you go to this place, I'll just charge you $50 more as a convenience fee. For the want of a better word, I think the French of this is chutiapa. That is the thing that the government has to prevent from happening. Because that's exactly what happens. You know, most of the healthcare horror stories that I listen are essentially you go to a hospital, you're sick, and then they basically charge you stuff that you haven't even used. That's the crookery part of it. It's got nothing to do with pharma companies. Pharma companies aren't making money out of that. It's the hospital which is. So first of all, focus your ire on the right persons. It's not the doctor too. It's the people running the hospital which are doing it. And the doctor doesn't know either. Or the doctor may be on it also. I don't know. Could be. But the fact is that ultimately, the reason why pharma is, and if you look at the salaries, it's not that, you know, that pharma company salaries are huge. I mean, pharma companies get paid pretty okay, but they're not, if compared to Google and compared to Facebook and compared to Amazon, it's nothing. And that's just the way capitalism is. The reason why engineers and subject matter experts get paid so highly in these big four companies is just because they make the amount of revenue they make. You know, Amazon doesn't take a lot of risk at this point of time in terms of its core business. Neither does Google. But pharma companies every day, they take a huge amount of risk with new drug development. And they have to. And just like movies, some drugs, even when some drugs are effective, when you can prove that they're effective, some drugs are flops. I mean, some drugs come out like Puru Rajkumar. I mean, you spend a lot of money on them and then they flop.
It's just that perhaps it was not marketed. Perhaps people figured out, no, it's not worth the cost of it. There are other drugs which might not be that effective, but kind of do the same thing. So there's a lot of, you know, timing and marketing. And somebody sent me a link. Look at the amount of money that pharma companies spread on marketing. Yeah, yeah. Welcome to capitalism, man. Drugs are sold just like your PlayStation 5. It's just the same thing.
You're paying not just for Anil Kapoor, but also for Sanjay Kapoor.
Yes, yes, exactly. You're playing for both. And you're paying now for Sonam Kapoor also.
Exactly.
So you have to understand that this is... That, of course, there are bad actors in pharma, but the very fact that right now the only hope that the world has is basically two pharma companies should at least convince you of the fact that when Bernie Sanders says that big pharma is evil, that is not true, because evil guys don't save the world. That's the first thing in any fantasy novels. Evil guys don't save the world. Pharma company people who come to work to, you know, they're greedy just like you are. They are fallible just like you are. They have bills to pay just like you do. The only difference between you and them is that the guy in the pharma company has a chance, which may come once in a generation, to save the world. That's something which not all of us get, that privilege. And yes, you have to pay them for that once in a generation thing to, you know, that's why you have to attract the best talent. You have to have the best equipment. You have to have the best infrastructure in place. You have to quickly yank out, you know, anybody who's been in the healthcare industry knows the cost, the human cost of getting big clinical studies running and the amount of oversight there is on, and a genuine oversight there is on clinical studies. This is not, you know, fake data that is collected by your garden variety management consultant here. Okay, this is real data that has to be present, that has to be available, and that has to be, you know, that is looked through by multiple people, including just adversaries. So these have to stand, and in order to create that amount of data, there's a lot of cost of collecting it. And in such a short period of time for this to happen, when, you know, normally to develop a vaccine, it takes 7 to 10 years. So obviously that $1 billion went to basically turbocharge this and get us here.
Right. In fact,
obviously it went for something.
When the pandemic started, we had coronavirus specialist, I think Dr. Pavitra. She said the earliest we can get to is in probably next March. So this is, I mean, and that would take a miracle. And here we are in November with two. So this is amazing.
Yes, it is amazing. And these amazing things happen because you pay for it. And I'm not saying that there is no need for government regulations. I'm always for government regulations, especially when it comes to safety and efficacy of drugs. But that cost of government regulation is passed over on to your customer, whether they say it or not. That is why, you know, these things, these white balls of powder cost so much, even though they don't seem to be what is there. Once you know what is to be put in it, it's right. It doesn't take a lot of cost to produce. But right now for the vaccine, you have to understand that the vaccine and a tablet are not the same. With vaccine, there is a huge requirement of keeping it in the proper temperature. One of the vaccines is a very low temperature that it needs to be kept in order for it to be efficacious. So all of this means, there was a cyber attack right before that on one of the biggest cold storage suppliers of drugs, right before this thing, drugs and food, before this. So I tweeted and said, this was very concerning. And man, in this day and age, I don't think there are coincidences. There are no coincidences in this day and age, honestly, with what's going on at nation state level. You'd wonder, why would anybody want to attack the cold storage, guys, during coronavirus? This is why. So again, this is a point that I wanted to make. Somebody said on Twitter, I made a few tweets and said, why don't you discuss this in your next podcast? So here it is. Yes, this is something which I think needs to be brought about. And this leads to an enormous amount of negativity against doctors, which I see all the time. And it just, I'm not a doctor myself, but, and I've had bad experiences with doctors too. But why would anybody want to be a doctor, really? I mean, there's no doubt that, yeah, sure, a doctor makes money, but you know, the amount of risk that a doctor runs, you can understand this during COVID times, but at any time, the amount of risk that a doctor runs, not only to get infected, to be sued, to not have a life, this is not compensated by the amount of money we pay doctors. So there is definitely a part of this is not just a profession, this is a calling. There definitely is a part of it. And when I see people like Bernie Sanders, who really don't care any, you know, they don't care, that they're trying to vilify an entire profession, I think I have to step up and say that this is not true. This is not the way the medical industry works. Anyways, that's the episode for today. And we were off last week. So if anybody's wondering what happened by missing a week's episode, no, I was off last week. And so, yeah, so thanks a lot for listening.
That's it. So we hope you enjoyed this one. Please leave your comments on the discussion page or Twitter. And of course, you know about Patreon, you know about clicking the show notes, getting to Amazon, all of that. So do all of that and take care. Bye-bye.